Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of the hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today to be interviewing Kate Phillips about her book titled Bought and Sold that's come out this year in 2022 from Lewath Press up in Scotland, which is a really interesting book that looks at the slave trade in the British Empire, and specifically the role of Scots and Scotland in this piece of history that I think a lot of us are beginning to understand more about and really have quite a lot of responsibility to understand and learn more. So this book is a really key piece of that history and understanding kind of two particular parts of the British Empire, Scotland and Jamaica, and how they kind of go together in this particular way. So I'm very excited to welcome you, Kate, to the podcast.
And I'm very happy to talk with you today.
Wonderful. Can we start off, please, with you introducing yourself a bit and explaining why you decided to write this book?
Yes, I'm a social development specialist. I'm retired. I used to work with adults teaching about rights and encouraging accountability in community organisations. I work worldwide with lots of organisations, political parties in Africa, and at one point I taught trade unionists from the Caribbean. But I never really intended to write a book. I went on a visit to Jamaica after I retired, and I found so much that was Scottish in the island. It surprised me because apart from Jamaica Street in Glasgow, there's not a trace of any Jamaican history here in Scotland that I knew of anyway. I started reading when I got home, but I found very little about the Scots in Jamaica in our history books. So I had to go back to first-hand accounts. And actually, there were loads more of these than I ever imagined. Diaries, letters, newspaper articles from those times, so much material that I started writing it all down. So that's how it all began. It was a bit of an obsession. I wanted to understand what Scots were doing in Jamaica and what was that history. Obviously, I knew it was connected to slavery, and I also felt that that was perhaps one reason why it wasn't easy to find that history, that it had been blotted out. We have no Jamaicans, very few Jamaicans in Scotland, and the history had been completely hidden. So that's how I got started.
Well, that's a pretty good way to start. I'm curious about this thing. Oh, wait, there's not a lot of information. Guess I need to go digging. I think that's how a lot of good books start off, because then there's a very clear sort of goal and point to this.
I kept sort of scratching the surface and getting deeper and deeper into things, because the more I found, the more I needed to know more to understand. So it's like a mining of research, of information.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, you've mined quite a lot of really interesting information in the book, so I'm hoping that through the interview we can kind of touch on maybe sort of a highlights tour, or kind of a quick tour of some of the highlights, some of the most interesting pieces of the book, to really understand this bit of history that has not been told a lot. So to start off with, kind of the obvious place, can you help us understand why young Scottish men in particular were in many cases actually preferred for jobs in and around slave trade plantations, etc., in Jamaica?
Well, I think there were push and pull factors. For all classes in the 1700s, we're talking really here about the 1700s, good opportunities at home in Scotland were rather scarce. Scotland was quite a poor country at the start of the 1700s. Now, the Scottish Parliament had passed legislation in the late 1600s to implement parish education. It wasn't implemented everywhere, but most parishes had a school. And those schools were practical Presbyterian. It was a practical Presbyterian education system, and it stressed hard work, self-reliance, reading and writing, but also a very practical arithmetic for measuring and bookkeeping and those kind of skills. Those were exactly the kind of skills that were needed in the colonies and in particular in plantations. So I think that there was a fit, and the Scots had always been sailors. They got around Scotland by sailing. A lot of them had gone over the Atlantic, young men followed looking for jobs, and they had the skills that were needed to take up those jobs.
And why was it that so many Scottish men in particular had those skills? Because it does seem like it was disproportionate to other parts of the empire, perhaps.
Well, I think that you'd have to look at the Presbyterian education system, the way that the church worked in Scotland. There was a belief, a very strong belief during the 1600s, that everybody had to be taught to read their Bibles, that everybody had to be, that Scotland was a special place that was going to become like a second Israel, you know, God's country, that was going to be hardworking and with people who knew God's word. And they had argued that nobody else should interpret, there should be no hierarchy in the church, that the ordinary people should understand God's word and read his book. And that was why the education system was the way it was, and why it was so widespread, possibly before other parts of Europe.
That makes sense. Thank you for explaining that. I'd like to turn then to some of the information that we have from these young Scottish men performing all sorts of bookkeeping jobs in Jamaica. And you tell us about some of these accounts, for example, John Hamilton's. What can we learn about slavery in Jamaica from these kinds of accounts?
Well, because most planters borrowed money from Scotland to set themselves up in Jamaica, they sent home lists of slaves and many letters. This is some of the material that was so interesting for me. Many letters about the state of the enslaved workforce, because they were in debt to bankers and these bankers needed to know, or they were working for a family who had gone home to Scotland, and that family expected to live at a very high standard. I think that the Jamaican planters were famed for their extravagance when they got home. So what we can learn is that they sent home, that there is a lot of information available which tells us exactly what was going on the plantation. What we do know is that they drove the slaves very hard to pay back the loans and to maximize profits for the family at home. They wanted to, but the most startling thing for me was when you look at the detail of the list of slaves, you find that the typical field worker their backs would be scarred from being constantly whipped into line. Those typical slave, what we think of as a slave, was not a man at all. The people doing the heavy cane cutting work and digging were teenage girls.
Why?
Because the men were trained to do skilled jobs, there were a lot of skilled jobs on the plantations, so that it was the women, and this Jamaican workforce worked harder we know from the economic evidence, worked harder than any workforce ever before or since. Investors demanded greater and greater returns, and these and the heavy, heavy work was left to the girls. The men on the plantation would become sugar boilers and distillers and carpenters and take on all the skilled jobs, bricklayers, masons, and the list. All the jobs are listed on the information that went home, and it's you can see that the field workers were girls, not wholly girls, but they were predominated, which is not how we think of it.
Mm-hmm. And another thing, perhaps that's not as we think, is you talk about in the book how there are actually relatively equal numbers of men and women who were enslaved in Jamaica. And you've already mentioned a few of the kind of contributing factors towards that. But what impact did this have for the colony in general?
Well, the slave trade database shows that the import of slaves was 60% men. But what if we look at the slave lists, we can see that the women generally live longer and survive better. Now, that's true for any society. Baby girls thrive better than baby boys. But that in itself isn't really sufficient to wholly explain the better female survival rate. Plantations typically, if we look at the slave list, had many more worn out old women and then a lot of young men. So there was a bit of a mismatch there. In terms of partnerships, young women were in short supply, and they were in many ways used and abused for sex by both white and black men, leading to high rates of venereal disease amongst both sexes and all classes. But the other result was a lack of any kind of stable family life compared to, let's say, other colonies like Virginia. And I don't honestly know why women survived so much better despite the punishing jobs. I've just said they worked harder than any workforce we've ever known. And the endemic sexual abuse, which is well documented, my guess is that perhaps each enslaved person was given a plot of land of their own from which they grew on which they grew their food. And possibly I felt that from selling surplus fruit and vegetables, which we know they did in the markets, they became petty businesswomen with a bit of money in their hands, and maybe they got some solace from that. I was puzzled, but it's definitely, when you look at the slave lists and the numbers on plantations, they did even up. Men died more readily, although women were field workers.
Hmm. I'm wondering if you can tell us a bit more about those plots of land and the ability to generate essentially private income from that.
Yes.
What kind of enabled that to be possible, given how harsh the conditions were for enslaved people on Jamaica?
Yes. Each estate found it cheaper to the merchants when the planters sent their sugar home. The merchants who received that sugar kept the accounts for the estate, and they charged exorbitant prices for imported food. And so the easiest solution for the plantations was to allot each slave a little bit of rough hillside land that couldn't be used for sugar, from which to feed themselves. But they were allowed to sell the surplus. Now, the Scots socialised in Jamaica, socialised over extravagant meals in their impressive homes. They wanted fresh poultry, they wanted fish, salt pork, eggs, fruit, vegetables. All of these were bought in the market, and they were produced and sold mainly by enslaved women. So each estates trained the men, as I've just said. Each estate found it cheaper to train the sugar boilers, the distillers of rum, the carpenters, the bricklayers, and they were also allowed to hire themselves out to the neighbours on their days off. So the enslaved people had a great drive to survive, and they they had almost two lives. They were working on the plantation, but they also, on their day off, did a bit of skilled work and a bit of business, and generated a bit of income, many of them. So they provided the Scottish population with all of the food, that, fresh food that they needed. So this wasn't a system they particularly wanted to disturb, because it saved them money from buying in food. It provided them with what they wanted. But I think they also felt it tied the enslaved community to the piece of land that they were on. If they ran away from the plantation, how were they going to eat? When they had their gardens and they had their food in their gardens, and that also sort of tied them to the neighborhood, and I think that was also a factor. But it is surprising that they allowed this business to go on. And from time to time, it was discussed, but it was always decided that it should continue. And it settled down in the very early days of slavery in Jamaica that this was how things were run.
Interesting. I was particularly interested in the book that it did come up every so often, and yet the result even of political debates were, no, we're going to keep it this way, which is always quite interesting when you see things like that.
Yes. The pressure to maximize income was very, very strong, and the cost of imported food was very, very high, and for those reasons, I think they found it so much cheaper and easier to let it continue.
Hmm. I'd love to ask about another aspect of the book, which is, of course, something very famous about Scotland, the importance of clan relationships and familial ties. To what extent and in what ways were those relevant in Jamaica as well?
In the 1700s, the whole system worked on trust. You've got bankers on one side of the Atlantic, and you've got the borrowers on the other side. So the borrowing money, the getting work, getting a place to live, this was all done on trust. So obviously your family relationships, your clan relationships are important in building that trust. When young men came from Scotland, they would be taken into people's homes, people from their friends, relatives, friends of friends from their home areas. I looked at a lot of letters of young men writing home saying, I found a friend from home and he's taken me in and he's going to help me find work. It's a similar system that works in many parts of the world today, that country cousins come to town and are looked after by friends and relatives until they get an opening. So for the workers crossing the Atlantic, it was important, but also it was very important for borrowing money, that you had that trust, that family relationship. And then the community in Scotland and the community in Jamaica, the white community, traveled back and forth between the countries, between the two countries. They sent their children home to be educated. They got together to enjoy familiar Scottish food and entertainment on the other side of the Atlantic. So there was a Scottish, a definitive Scottish community in Jamaica, who helped each other, lent each other money, they looked after each other. This was, I think, one reason why once the Scottish young men came, they would stick it out and stay, because they had that support.
Hmm. And how then did it work on a political level? How were the relations between the Scottish people on Jamaica versus back in Scotland, or ties in England? How did kind of those connections and communities function in terms of political influence?
Mm. The planters and the slave traders, the original, often came from existing landed families or influential merchant families, and they consciously built their political influence to defend, because Jamaica was a British colony, it was important to them that they staked a claim there and built their political influence. So the Scottish members of the British Parliament after 1707 were almost every one of them pro-slavery. You wouldn't get a seat in Parliament without being in favour. And because there was, during the 1700s, there was a build-up of opposition. And those people who didn't come from that landed class or influential class, spent their money, the people with new colonial money, used some of it to buy the kind of land and property which would give them political power in Scottish communities. So by the mid to late 1700s, when anti-slavery was gaining ground, they had consolidated their power over borough councils, parliamentary seats. And the end of slavery couldn't have happened without the 1832 Reform Bill, which changed the franchise and swept all these people out of Parliament. But they were to resist the anti-slavery movement, and that was the Presbyterian Church, the grassroots of the Presbyterian Church were anti-slavery. And to resist that, they unleashed a massive propaganda war, funding tours of Jamaica to get people to write favorably about the place, publishing favorable paintings showing happy slaves and accounts of Jamaican life. The press and the Scottish magazines had letters, articles, books, all defending what was going on in Jamaica. And they also made vehement attacks on leading anti-slavery campaigners. The anti-slavery movement concentrated on Parliament, on changing the law. And the slavers eventually lost that legal battle, but they did win a very important propaganda victory, I think. All of that propaganda that they put out established an idea of white supremacy, which was born and has lived on, I think, you know, born in that time, but lived on. The arguments that we use to justify slavery, that Africans benefited from or needed white care and ownership, there are echoes of this propaganda that are still alive today. The Christian missions that went to Jamaica were very much based on the idea that white people could provide moral guidance. The underlying story really was that black men were perhaps vicious and dangerous without this white guidance, and that black women were sexually promiscuous and immoral. They needed white control. And these ideas, I think, were implanted very deeply and have some consequences today. I'm not saying we believe these things today, but somehow that white supremacist thinking, I think it has lived on. And maybe one of the reasons why no Jamaicans ever came to settle in Scotland, even more recently. The Windrush generation didn't settle down in Scotland. They settled in the Northwest, and they settled in, and there were black populations in Liverpool, in Cardiff, in Bristol, in London. Anywhere that ships came in from Jamaica, there was a black population, but we didn't have one in Scotland. And I think that that's partly because that white supremacist propaganda was very, very strong.
What was the role within that, and generally in terms of the conversations around slavery, of the Scottish Presbyterian Church in particular?
The hierarchy of the Scottish Church, as the kind of established national religion, they were ambivalent about slavery. It came up regularly in the assembly of the Scottish Church, because it was in that sense a kind of democratic church. It came up regularly, but they noted it, or they noted the concern, but they didn't at that level do anything about it. The Scottish religion, the Kirk, is decentralised in its decision making. The local elders have quite a lot of autonomy, and many of them petition Parliament. The Scots were overrepresented in the petitions to Parliament, partly because of all these local churches signing petitions. And local Presbyterians, some of those who had inherited estates in Jamaica, were kind of uncomfortable, if they were good Christians, with being associated with slavery. And they, some of them partnered with so local Presbyterians in Scotland partnered up with reform-minded planters, people, Scottish planters who'd come home and were a little concerned about slavery. And these people sent the first missions to work with enslaved people on the plantations. Now, these missions were about establishing respect for the Sabbath, Christian family life, moral guidance. They taught obedience. They were not necessarily concerned with the exploitation and the money-making out of enslaved people. But the enslaved Africans were drawn into Christianity because it was the one place that gave them some dignity, that recognized their oppression, that treated them as human beings. The missions in Jamaica were resisted by the local Jamaican planters, sometimes very violently. They attacked and harassed the ministers and the congregations. They attempted to destroy the churches that had been built. They were very aggressive and violent in their resistance to these Christian missions from Scotland.
Thank you for explaining that. I think the structure of the kirk is quite an interesting aspect for kind of explaining the variation within Scotland in particular. But staying on kind of this question of debates around slavery, the movement to abolish slavery in Britain, what did you find in your research and that you talk about in the book around the impact of the loss of the American colonies and the French Revolution when it came to this debate?
I think the loss of Virginia, the loss of the American colonies, empowered the planter community in the Jamaican Assembly because they could use it to resist reform in slave conditions, and they would threaten to break away and become independent, do what America had done. And Jamaica was very important financially. It was worth much, much more than all the tobacco in Virginia to the British economy. But because they had such a favourable tax regime for their sugar, it's unlikely that they would have actually done it and actually broken away. But the threat of that was powerful. And if we look at one of the good examples of that is 1823, the revived anti-slavery movement had got the British Parliament, the King and the government to agree that there should be slave reform, that there should be the reform of slave conditions, there should be a new slave law which gave slaves rest days on the Sabbath and a list of new conditions. But because the Jamaicans absolutely refused to implement this, and the King and the British government did not want to force it onto the Jamaicans and force the issue, it was never implemented. The reforms that had been fought for in Britain were not actually implemented in Jamaica, and as a result of that, there was a slave revolt on the Scottish estates in Jamaica, because the enslaved people knew that reforms had been agreed and that their planter bosses were refusing to implement them. So it led to quite a serious revolt in 1823.
Skipping ahead a little bit, obviously slavery is eventually abolished. The enslaved people on Jamaica are freed, and the plantation owners were compensated for the loss of their, quote, property. What happened after that? Plantation owners now have a whole bunch of money. Enslaved people are now freed, apparently. The trade is slave trade has stopped, then what?
Well, I don't think freedom wasn't immediate. And if we look at the statistics, the slave trade doesn't stop. But what happened was that a system of apprenticeship, so-called, was introduced. All enslaved Africans over 6 years old had to work for their former masters, and they were going to be paid. This system never worked. It was abandoned as unworkable. It was supposed to go on for 5 years, but it didn't actually. It was abandoned early on because it just wasn't working. Because many Africans, those with a bit of money, bought plots of land. Others squatted on abandoned estates, and they used the skills they had as men and women to develop the alternative lives that they could control for themselves. So if they were carpenters, if they were cooks, if they'd got a bit of land, they could grow stuff for themselves. So they began a new life. They began to design and control a new life for themselves with the skills that they had. Now, some of the plantations did pay wages to former slaves. They found they couldn't make the same profit. Many of them just walked away, but they kept their land titles just in case money-making opportunities might arise in the future. So modern Jamaicans, many of them are consequently still squatters who've lived for generations on land that they don't own. So when I made my visit to Jamaica, the mountains where runaways hid years ago, and the shores where enslaved people tended their plots to feed themselves now have tourist potential, and the inheritors of long ago owners are turning up to claim it, as I realized when I holidayed at a place called Brighton Beach, where the community said to me that they were squatters and somebody would come back to claim their land, and they'd been there for generations, and this is another spur to my work. Could I look into it for them? And I said, I'm Scottish. I don't know anything about Jamaica. Why would I be able to help? And they said, well, exactly because you are Scottish, and it was British law at the time that's relevant. And we thought you could look into it. So I did. I did. But that was the enslaved Africans began to build themselves a new sort of peasant life, I suppose, initially, but with the skills that they developed during the plantation era.
Well, it clearly sounds like first you were quite committed to uncovering rather a lot in pursuit of this initial question, and that along the way there were at least a few surprises. The one you've just told us of being asked about this, and you're like, well, what does that have to do with Scotland? And going, oh, wait, hang on. But I'm wondering if, kind of thinking about this whole process of research and writing the book, if there's maybe one or two other things you might be willing to share with us that you found surprising?
I suppose one of my surprise, I couldn't quite get over the history of Jamaica in Scottish lives in Jamaica, and the numbers of Scottish people who had been in Jamaica had disappeared, because there would have been a period in, if you'd lived in Glasgow in the late 1700s, the newspapers, everybody would have known somebody who was connected with Jamaica. The newspapers had, there was sufficient interest for the newspapers in Glasgow to run a column called Plantation News, which told everybody what was going on in Jamaica. The anti-slavery movement, the country was divided. The question was a huge question. It was dealt with in all the newspapers. It was dealt with in the Kirk. It was a huge question for everybody, and yet it had disappeared, apart from a little bit of history of how of the anti-slavery movement. That I couldn't quite come to terms with, because I felt, had people willfully suppressed it, or was it just forgotten? What had happened there? Because there was so much history, and there is anybody who went into archives, anybody who looked at the Glasgow economy, historically, must have seen it. because it didn't take much digging, to dig out a whole lot of information that was surprising to me.
Why do you think it was forgotten?
I think because the anti-slavery movement won, in the sense that they won the argument, and maybe the Kirk, which was very powerful, and the Christian thinking felt embarrassed, felt uneasy about that part of their history. They preferred to wipe it out, I think. And I think we've all, to a certain extent, the whole of Britain has done that. But I do think it was rather complete in Scotland. It was rather effectively done. And of course, that's changing now. And there is a lot more research being done, a lot more being written, and a lot more work going on. And the University of Glasgow has been particularly active there. And the city also has acknowledged its role. And so things are changing, but it's taken 200 or 300 years for this to happen.
Well, you've given us rather a lot to think about, and obviously the book has so much more detail that I definitely want to point listeners to. But as you do seem to kind of get quite involved in projects, are you taking a break now that this book is out, or is there another project that you're getting stuck into you can give us a sneak preview of?
Oh, my working title at the moment is The Scots, the English and the Union. I've did so much work on the Scottish history around the 1600s, 1700s that I became interested in what did Scots lose at the time of the Union in 1707 that has actually stayed with them to be revived at the moment? You know, that what is it they thought they had lost? What is it that they which drives them at the moment towards independence? We're in a situation where half of the country is for and half is against. It's a little bit like the anti-slavery division in that sense, half for, half against. So I'm intrigued and interested in trying to trace what it was that they thought they lost.
Interesting. Certainly not a straightforward topic, so I'm sure that that end result will also be absolutely fascinating. But while you are off working on that, listeners can read the book that we've been discussing, which again is called Bought and Sold, out this year in 2022 from Lewath Press. Kate Phillips, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me.